This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Here in Hamilton County, the coronavirus pandemic has hit certain communities the hardest. A recent story by Wyatt Massey in the Chattanooga Times Free Press shares the numbers. Hispanic residents represent 6% of the county's population, but around half of all confirmed cases and a third of all local deaths. Black residents represent 19% of the county's population, but another third of the deaths, with cases increasing by more than 40% since July 1st, more than double the increase among white residents. Ladarius Price knows about these disparities firsthand. He is Community Outreach Manager at Sempa Community Care here in Chattanooga.
Ladarius, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about what you have been seeing out in the community, what you have been hearing from people, especially when it comes to the disparities for COVID-19.
When we first started on this journey, there was not a lot of testing in the minority communities. So Sempa stepped up to the plate and we partnered with Aleo Health, which is also recognized as Hospice of Chattanooga, as well as Life Springs Pediatrics. And the three of us formed a cohort to go into the communities that were not being, no one was giving them the attention that they needed as it related to being tested. And when we kicked that off, it went over extremely well. A lot of those neighborhoods that are not able to get access to adequate health care, a lot of those neighborhoods that don't have the same type of benefits that a lot of other neighborhoods have, we were able to get testing done there. So we started off on that journey, and it went over, like I said, really well. I also want to highlight the fact that you can't go into those communities. And I think I said this in our last interview, you can't go into those communities without a relationship. It's impossible, because once you show up there, you're not going to get the type of response that's needed to facilitate you doing that work and getting care to those residents. So because we already had a relationship with them, it was easier for us to go into those communities and get COVID-19 testing done. And now you fast forward into now, just a couple of weeks ago, maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago, we seen where at that point in time, there were about 5 African-Americans that passed from COVID-19, and they were between the ages of 50 and 81. But, you know, during that time frame, everybody that had passed from it was African-American. So we see in this, I want to be very clear when I say, no, we are not the only ones that are affected by a lot of the disparities, but it needs to be highlighted that because we suffer from hypertension and high blood pressure and diabetes and so many other things, heart disease, and I can go on and on with the disparities that affect us, HIV and a number of other STIs. We've seen in Hamilton County where we're 3 times and 5 times more likely to die from some of these things. And it's because we don't have access to the type of healthcare that we need. We're not a priority. I'll say that not from a malicious place, but I'm just being very transparent and truthful. We're not a priority in a lot of communities. And that's why you see the disparities and they continue to rise. And this COVID-19 has just become another brick on top of the pile that is already weighing very heavily on our communities, because once again, we don't have access to the healthcare that we need a lot of times.
And you talk about relationships, and relationships all come down to trust, not only during this pandemic, but before the pandemic hit.
Yeah, I mean, for so long, this stuff has been going on. A lot of us are extremely tired. It hurts to see so many people hurting. To know that the resources are there and the resources are just not being put in the places that they need to be, it's a very hurtful thing, especially for, you know, someone such as myself of color that I'm working in this on the front lines every day and seeing it. And I thank God every day for a Sempa Community Care. We are not the only group, But we are one of the groups that continue to fight so that people of color can get the type of services that they need. So, I mean, this fight is, and I say fight because, I mean, literally that's what it is. And it's been ongoing for a long time. And, you know, COVID-19 coming along, it has just made it even worse. It didn't highlight anything. It didn't tell us anything that we didn't already know. You know, it just, like I said, it's just another brick on top of the pile that we're trying to pull through and get people the services that they so desperately need.
Food insecurity is one of those other bricks.
Most definitely. I mean, that right there, like the statement that you just made, that if we take COVID-19 away and we say, okay, it is past and we're done with it, that disparity of a lot of families not having adequate, nutritious, healthy meals of substance on a day-to-day basis, that's going to continue to go on, and I hate to say it, forever. And we are one of the richest countries in the world. You know, I've been able and blessed to travel abroad and go to different places. Just last summer, I was in Haiti. I mean, it'll bring you to tears when you go to different countries and see how they so desperately need food and things of that nature. But right here in my own backyard, in this great country that we have that's very rich, there are so many people that lack a meal of substance on a day-to-day basis. Being in this work, working with numerous youth on a day-to-day basis, and me knowing, you know, during this time, if school is not in, for a lot of them, the only meal that they get on most days comes from school. So when they're eating breakfast and lunch at school, that's their opportunity to eat. Well, as we all know, since March of this year, school has not been in. Now, we're getting ready to go back to school, and there's so much uncertainty up in the air where some kids are going to go back in the building, some are going to stay at home. But once again, the elephant is still going to be in the room where a lot of our kids are not going to have a meal. So we've been blessed to, you know, take some of the resources that we have here and partner with other groups, people that are personal friends of mine that have organizations that are serving on the front lines and doing the work. We've just all band together on a day-to-day basis and gone into some of these different communities to ensure that kids, as well as family, you know, kids are they are our first priority. But if we have enough, we're willing to feed adults as well. But kids can't feed themselves. So that's why they are our priority. Since March 16th, we've roughly served 15,200 meals since March 16th. So that's something that we're very proud of. Nothing to brag about, because even with that number and so many other numbers that are being quoted, there are still a number of people that are going without meals. So that disparity is going to continue to be there. And I hate to say that, but it's just the truth.
Another disparity involves people who need to get testing, not getting testing because they can't miss a day of work.
Those are facts. Those are facts. I mean, as I stated, and then we were at the very beginning of it then, Simpa has not closed. Simpa has not furloughed any employees. I talked about my wife who works at Unum. She hasn't been laid off. So my household, we have not wanted for anything. I'm a married man with 5 children. So we have not lacked or wanted for anything, but there are families during this time, of course, that have been laid off and places have closed. And people, you know, even though some were able to get unemployment, some have not been able to. You look at things like that and you say, okay, some people can't afford to miss a paycheck. No, some people can't afford to miss hours from work. When they look at their paycheck at the end of those 2 weeks, they can't miss an hour off of their paycheck. That's what surrounds us on a day-to-day basis when we talk about families that are going without the things that they need. And I mean, it continues on. We don't know at this point what the future holds. We don't know if we're going to go through another mass shutdown citywide, countrywide. It's being highly suggested because of how the numbers are climbing. So at the end of the day, a lot of those families that we're talking about right now, they will continue to suffer and they will continue to hurt, and people will continue to go without the things that they need, a lot of which many of us take for granted on a day-to-day basis.
In reading the story about this by Wyatt Massey in the Chattanooga Times Free Press, in which you were quoted, you talk about not being able to see your own grandmother during this time to keep her safe from the virus. Talk to me about her.
My mother passed about 2 years ago, and my grandmother that I'm talking about in that particular part of the article, she's my mother's mother, and we've always had a very close relationship. I've always said that she's like my third parent. I was blessed to have, you know, be raised in a two-parent home, and I'm an only child, so I've always had everything that I've needed, and she's always been there. We've always had a great relationship. Even last night, I talked to her for about an hour. I talked to her earlier that day as well. So it's a relationship that has been very near and dear to my heart. She helped raise me. A lot of who I am as a man and as a husband and as a father, you know, she's responsible for it. She's 80. She'll be 81 in September, God willing. So for me to not be able to, we also attend the same church. So because of where church is, where we are as a country, not being able to go and worship because of everything that's going on, I don't see her weekly like I normally would even at church. With me serving on the front line, I'm testing people twice a week. Of course, I'm 39 years old, so my immune system is functioning, of course, at a higher rate. But at the same time, I don't want to put my grandmother in harm's way. I don't want to run the risk of me contracting COVID and then me going over to see her and give her a hug or be in her presence and then give her COVID. It's sad to say, as we've seen, there have been, you know, grandmothers, a young lady that I went to school with, there was a story done about her grandmother. She worked at one of the chicken processing plants and she passed. So that's one of my classmates who no longer has her grandmother because of this virus. And I'm just not willing to run the risk of passing that on to my grandmother because of my selfish reasons of wanting to see her.
If people want to reach out to SEMPA, either for more information or to support, where can they go online? Where can they call?
We're always available at www.sempa.org. Our phone number, or I'll give mine, is 423-648-9920. We're on Facebook as well under SEMPA Community Care. So you can look us up there and stay abreast, really, of everything that we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And as we, you know, move forward in this fight of everything that we do, you know, we still have our clients and our patients and our family members, that I like to call them, that we're caring for. We're primarily known as an HIV and STI clinic. We are a federally qualified health center now where we have primary care. So we have people that we're caring for. But at the same time, we're going out into the community and we're doing testing and we're doing follow-ups and things of that nature. So, and as we know, those types of things, they're not free, but we're taking our resources and really pouring them back into the community. So, you know, shout out to us and all of the work that we continue to do with other organizations. But that's how you can reach us.
All right. Ladarius, thanks so much. And thank you and everybody on the front lines for all that you are doing for so many people.
Thank you.
Twice a week online, the Bessie Smith Cultural Center here in Chattanooga features community members reading children's books to spur dialogue on race relations. The digital series is called Bessie's Front Porch, and yesterday, attorney Ariel Anthony read Of Thee I Sing, A Letter to My Daughters by former President Barack Obama, illustrated by Lauren Long. Here's part of that reading.
Have I told you lately how wonderful you are? How the sound of your feet running from afar brings dancing rhythms to my day. How you laugh and sunshine spills into the room. Have I told you that you are creative? A woman named Georgia O'Keeffe moved to the desert and painted petals, bone, bark. She helped us see big beauty in what is small, the hardness of stone and the softness of feather. Have I told you that you are smart? That you braid great ideas into imagination? A man named Albert Einstein turned pictures in his mind into giant advances in science, changing the world with energy and light. Have I told you that you are brave? A man named Jackie Robinson played baseball and showed us all how to turn fear to respect and respect to love. He swung his bat with the grace and strength of a lion and gave brave dreams to other dreamers. Have I told you that you are a healer? Sitting Bull was a Sioux medicine man who healed broken hearts and broken promises. It is fine that you are different, he said, for peace is not necessary for eagles to be crows. Though he was put in prison, his spirit soared free on the plains, and his wisdom touched the generations. Have I told you that you have your own song? A woman named Billie Holiday wore a gardenia in her hair and sang beautiful blues to the world. Her voice, full of sadness and joy, made people feel deeply and add their melodies to the chorus. Have I told you that you are strong? A woman named Helen Keller fought her way through long, silent darkness. Though she could not see or hear, she taught us to look at and listen to each other. Never waiting for life to get easier, she gave others courage to face their challenges. Have I told you how important it is to honor other sacrifices? A woman named Maya Lin designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial to remember those who gave their lives in the war, and the Civil Rights Memorial to thank the many who fought for equality. Public spaces should be filled with art, she thought, so that we could walk amongst it, recalling the past and inspired to fix the future. Have I told you that you are kind? A woman named Jane Addams fed the poor and helped them find jobs. She opened doors and gave people hope. She taught adults and invited children to play and laugh and let their spirits grow wide. Have I told you that you don't give up? When violence erupted in our nation, a man named Martin Luther King Jr. taught us unyielding compassion. He gave us a dream that all races and creeds would walk hand in hand. He marched and he prayed, and one at a time opened hearts and saw the birth of his dream in us.
Watch the entire readings from Bessie's Front Porch on the Facebook page and YouTube channel for the Bessie Smith Cultural Center. New readings appear online at 11 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon on Talking Writing, my guest is Colin Woodard, a journalist, an author, and an historian. His last book was titled American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. His central thesis in the book is that America is not a coalition of 50 states, but rather of 11 semi-autonomous regions. His new book, Union, builds on that thesis, asking if we are in fact a nation of 11 loosely aligned regions, when did the idea of the United States begin? Who conceived and propagated the American myth when, as Colin Woodard sees it, the country is in fact the product of several competing myths? He attempts to answer these questions in a book that weaves the biographies of five very influential men, an historian from a family of New England Puritans, George Bancroft, who wrote a 10-volume history of the United States in the 19th century, William Gilmore Sims, an historian from the antebellum South and a contemporary of George Bancroft, who took extreme issue with Bancroft's vision of the country, Frederick Douglass, a black man born into slavery, a powerful orator who had a profound influence on Abraham Lincoln and many other leaders, both before and after the Civil War, Later in the narrative, he tells the story of Woodrow Wilson's rise to the presidency and his relationship with another historian, Frederick Jackson Turner, who propagated yet another version of the American myth. I have to tell you, I read your book essentially over the past weekend, which may have been an appropriate time to read it, I guess, July 4th weekend. And I loved it. You know, it's just the kind of narrative that you've written can so easily devolve into something that's fairly dry and dusty. And you have all of the techniques of a novelist in the way you wrote the book and introduced these stories in a way that you know, that I think for many people, the biggest challenge with history is to understand that these are real, breathing people, just like us, who live just as we do, essentially, albeit in a different time.
That was, in fact, what I was aiming for. And, you know, it's basically a historiography of ideas. What could end up being drier than that, right? And yet incredibly important. So not only is it more compelling that way, but also I wrote another book in this fashion about the Golden Age pirates with a sort of structurally it's a, you know, multiple biography with the streams, you know, alternating between narrative streams and they collide. But I found with that book, and I want to do this one this way, is that when you research something for a multiple biography, it actually greatly enhances the research because you're asking questions and looking for things that people who weren't doing that way wouldn't. And they're often very revealing things about, you know, the actual people and their interactions and combinations and what they're bringing to a critical meeting or collision at that moment. And unless you were doing it in that fashion, you'd have no idea.
I'm caught between wanting to ask you two different streams of questions. On the one hand, I kept thinking, oh my God, I've written a dissertation. I know how it is to take a lot of disparate material and try to organize it, but this is must have been mind-boggling as a, where do you start to organize material like this? I guess to frame that in the form of a question, my first question to you would be, in that other stream...
Yeah, should I treat this like it's the tape interview at this point, or how should we proceed?
Yes, this is an interview. I'm trying to figure out how best to present your book to everybody listening, who I hope will understand that this is a book absolutely worthy of their time, even if they find history dull and they have... I mean, it's hard to imagine that there's a person walking on the planet who wouldn't have an interest in this narrative. What were you thinking when you first conceived this book, and how long ago was it that you began working on it?
Well, this book comes out of a previous book I wrote called American Nations, History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. And that book had argued that there's never been one America, but rather several, and that the differences between those separate regions or regional cultures or nations, if you will, tie back to the differences between the different colonial projects that formed on the eastern and southwestern rims of what's now the United States. And that those projects, the New England colonies, the Dutch-founded area around New York City, the Appalachian backcountry, the Chesapeake Tidewater, the Deep South, New Spain's colonization efforts from south to north into what's now the American Southwest, and so on, all were founded at different times with people with different ethnographic and religious and cultural characteristics who were building different political societies and had different original intents, if you will. And the differences, those fundamental differences in characteristics dating back sometimes to the 17th century, can still be seen in those cultures and in the areas of North America they each settled in almost mutually exclusive settlement tiers. In other words, there was not a lot of overlap between the New England and New England descendant tier that moved from east to west across upstate New York, the Western Reserve of Ohio, and the upper Great Lakes states, and the, say, the greater Appalachian tier that started in, you know, south central Pennsylvania and then extended into the western parts of Virginia and into Kentucky and then onwards, either down the Great Wagon Road into the uplands of what we consider the South and on into the Ozarks and Texas Hill Country, and also going down and rafting the Ohio River to settle the lower tiers of the lower Great Lakes states and on out into Iowa. That these, if you understand that geography, then you understand a great deal about the contradictions of our history and even our current political maps at the county level. So that said, having written that book, which received a fair bit of attention as a reset in understanding both regionalism and how to understand our history, that we're a balkanized federation, that tells us about, you know, why our constitutional arrangements came up the way they did, and why we, certain key circumstances in history, why there are these strange alliances at the state level. So that left the question, okay, you know, if all of this was the case, and I already knew from researching that book that people recognized this in the 1790s and the 1810s and so on, and in the 1850s and 60s for sure, during the Civil War era, at what point did we ever, you know, come to believe otherwise? Where did the story of the United States as a unitary nation with a common origin story, a common, you know, purpose and definition come from? Who created it and when and why? And how did it succeed, given this enormous structural barrier that existed, the fact that it was, in fact, sort of a myth? So that's where it came from. That question had always been in my mind. I wrote the other book, I was researching it probably 10 years ago, and it came out 9 years ago, so it's been percolating for a while. And union is the answer, the research to find out where our story of United States nationhood came from, because it was a story that had to be created, and as I learned, ended up being a story that was bitterly fought over between two rival interpretations.
Yes, I thought that was really interesting, too. I also thought that the parallels you drew, most immediately with Germany. I didn't realize that Germany as a country was so young. It's extremely less than 150 years, right?
Right. It was a collection of, you know, principalities and duchies and archduchies and small empires and electorates, and it wasn't one country, and it had to be made such. And so in the early 19th century, at the same time that the American myth was, you know, the first myth makers were out thinking about the United States and what it should be, Germany was thinking the same questions, although from a different starting position. They, like us, were sort of a balkanized potential federation. They were a confederation of the German states after Napoleon's defeat. They had a very loose alliance, like even looser than the European Union today, of sovereign kings and, you know, dukes and the like, who had borders between them. You had to go through customs between every one of these little micro states to get from one place to another. And they were talking about, shouldn't we be one nation? Shouldn't there be something called a Germany? And the difference with the United States is they could make the argument that they had a common culture and language and history. And even though that they were in separate sovereign states, that they actually were part of one nation. Whereas we Americans at the time, you know, if you ask somebody in 1820, you know, what country you were from, they would say Massachusetts or Virginia or South Carolina. What the United States was still pretty vague, even with the existence of a constitution. You know, there was no history to write of it. People weren't writing a history of the United States in the early 19th century. They were writing history of New Hampshire and a history of Virginia and the like, because those were the nations with a coherent story to tell themselves. And so, yes, there's an interplay that happens involving a specific individual, George Bancroft, who merge those traditions because as a young man, he was sent to Germany to study under some of the professors and intellectuals who were the fathers of the great ideas of what, you know, European nationhood should be.
Mm. It's funny, you know, I was watching a rather silly movie last night, and at points in the film, a man who purportedly was from Berlin kept saying, he's from Munich. You can't trust anybody from Munich. So evidently, you know, even though it was the entire film was kind of risible, I had the feeling that there's probably some truth to that. It's certainly true where I grew up that people from London were regarded with concern, sometimes disdain, by anybody, you know, living 100 miles north, and regarded as a completely different species. And the notion that, that Boris Johnson got elected because he recognized that, that there's no commonality, you know, and you can ignore London, although he's probably the first person to do that in some time. Everything in the UK is basically centered around London, and that's what gives the impression of a unified country, but it really isn't. So I'm not sure that any country, although we take it as a given that we're a united populace under a given flag, it's pretty much a mythology in most countries, don't you think?
Well, the whole idea of a nation is an abstract idea. You know, it's a creation that we've imagined in our heads, and it's one with enormous power. But you have to convince individuals that they somehow belong to something called the nation. Mm. No, you belong to a Germany, and fellow Germans are somehow more closely, you know, related to you, maybe in a genetic sense, but certainly in some kind of cultural or metaphysical sense, than people who are not. And, you know, that's a peculiar argument that's not really true of any nation. Some places can make that argument with a straighter face. It's easier to make that argument in Germany or Japan or certainly in Iceland, where most people may share a common cultural and historical thread of experience lived back a number of generations to imagine that they are sort of mystically one people, one tribe, if you will. But that's much harder to do in a country. You know, certainly the United Kingdom is an example of some of the complexity. It gets even more complex when you're talking about Canada or the United States, where there's none of that. There is no common thread, historical or otherwise, that ties all of the regions of the United States together. They were separate. You know, the colonial period, all those colonies were rivals with one another and often enemies. Even the you know, allegedly English or later British ones were often enemies with one another when things happened like the English Civil War in the 1640s. You know, the colonies rooted for opposite sides during the Great Revolution in 1689. Again, the colonies took different sides, even the English ones, and certainly those that were French or Dutch or Spanish had an entirely different, you know, take on things and were often at war with the colonies that were not. So I'm saying that that's not a lot of good material to work with in creating an imagined idea of nationhood. And yet, we did, and we did it so successfully that the United States, for long periods of its history, has been, you know, an ascendant and highly patriotic world power that's been able to accomplish remarkable things. And that just shows you the power of ideas. And why they're so important to understand, even if sometimes they seem like they're just abstract, you know, silly intellectual exercises.
Yes, and I think that there's the perception on the part of many people in this country, as I think is probably true, well, certainly true in the UK, that there's the government, which operates as a kind of, it's independent from their lives. They don't see themselves as the government. They see the government as an actor. And there are points when they become a pawn, if you will, in those actions, whenever there's a war or there's a something that threatens or is purported at least to threaten the country. So everybody comes together to stand against a common enemy.
Sure, shared enemy is often, you know, very helpful in unifying the people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how the United States happened, right? You had these separate colonies who didn't like each other or trust each other or share much in common, and they were all simultaneously threatened by a change in British policy that threatened the idiosyncrasies of each colony to rule itself in its own way. Essentially, London wanted conformity and obedience among the colonies to a level it had not previously required. And this resulted in these colonies grouping together, not all of them, but 13 of them, grouping together to fight off and, lo and behold, win a war of independence for themselves. And then that meant that accidentally they'd all wound up in a nation, in quotes, together, or at least a state. You know, there was something called the United States, and out of that common threat, they all were part of it, just nobody knew what it was.
Yeah, and those United States, there weren't very many of them. There certainly weren't 50 as there are now. It's kind of interesting to think about it in those terms, and after reading your book.
You know? 13 at the time, but even others that might have wanted to join in the War of Independence weren't able to, or had abortive attempts to, such as Nova Scotia, which, you know, included New Brunswick and other areas. What became Quebec, you know, Canada or Lower Canada, also had the possibility of seceding. And then all the Caribbean colonies, you know, Barbados and Jamaica and the Bahamas and all these places were also potential, you know, uprising spots. So it was a subset of the colonies that actually ended up doing this and doing it successfully. But yeah, they then ended up with a sort of artificial creation. You know, they had a military alliance, the Continental Army, and a provisional coordinating body, the Continental Congress, and they won a war, and they tried to throw together a constitution that didn't work very well, the Articles of Confederation. And then they came together to try to get a compromise that would suit everybody, given they didn't trust each other in the 1789 Constitution. And, you know, there remained questions as to exactly what defined the country as a country, why Virginians and Massachusettsians were in the same country, that persisted well into the 19th century when the story of union really kicks off.
So essentially, 13 states as we know them now devised this notion of a shining city on the hill, as George Bancroft put it, and of course has been quoted widely since then. It's a beautiful ideal. But first of all, it's not even a third of the ultimate United States that made this decision. And then so much of the United States was created out of this notion, again, an ideal, I guess, from one point of view, of manifest destiny.
Well, even stranger than that the country would eventually be larger was the fact that this original myth that was created, this original national narrative might be a better term, that was created by George Bancroft, who was a historian, is born in 1800, and he lived in the 1890s in a very long life, and he's the one who drafted the first take on what the United States was, combining the German influences he encountered as a very young graduate student in Germany in like 1818 and 1820 with his New England upbringing. And here's the key element is that hit that tradition, that idea, including, you know, Winthrop's quote about putting having a city on a hill and having errands into the wilderness and all that, that's all a New England tradition from the early Puritans. And George Bancroft was a descendant of early Puritans. He was born in Worcester, Massachusetts. His father was a prominent Congregational minister. He studied at Phillips Exeter and at Harvard. And he combined these German ideas about statehood with the early Puritans' ideas that they were a chosen people tasked by God to do certain things in the New World. The early Puritans believed that they were supposed to build a more godly society, that they were in a covenant, like an Old Testament covenant with God to do so, and that they collectively had this errand that they had to do. And George Bancroft said that Americans were chosen by God and Providence for a special mission, and that mission was to further human freedom, both in time and space and across the North American continent, and do so through the words encoded in the Declaration of Independence, which may have had some divine inspiration, according to Bancroft, those about the inherent equality of humans and their unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and consensual self-government. Very unusual statements in their time and place. And his argument was that God had chosen Americans, and that was our purpose, was to further those ideals. And that from the Germans, you took the idea that nations are like organisms. They're like, you take a seed, and from the instructions in a seed you've planted, the nation will unfold with certain characteristics that are preordained. and that those inherent characteristics, according to Bancroft, of Americans, that seeds were planted in South Carolina and Virginia and Massachusetts and so on. And these places may have appeared completely different at the time the seeds were planted, but there was really a divine plan. They were all the same seed growing this, you know, freedom-loving, providence-tasked peoples who would do great things in the world. And you can hear echoes of all that, of course, in the way people talk about America today. But that's where it all first came together, was in Bancroft's words encoded in his monumental History of the United States, which came out over 10 volumes over about 60 years, each one of them starting in the 1830s, a massive cultural event that shaped the way people thought about the country, talked about it, wrote about it, made their plays about it and everything else, and kicked off the conversation and ultimately the argument over what the United States was supposed to be, what its origin story was and its purpose and who belonged.
It's an intoxicating vision. It's easy to embrace his idealism, which I hesitate to say that, but it seems to me that it embraces the Christian ideal that every man or every person should treat every other person as they would wish to be treated themselves. That was the foundation of the country, and that was the kind of society we were going to create. Unfortunately, it runs full face into the economic imperative, which had an entirely different foundation and wasn't interested in ideals. It was interested in profit. And in some respects, wasn't this country first settled by people who came here because they thought they were going to make money?
To some extent, I mean, that's the thing, right? The country was settled at different times by different people in different parts of the country. That's why understanding that it's a balkanized federation is so key. Mm. So the early Puritans weren't here primarily to make money, although some of them surely did that. But the idea was that they were coming on a divine mission, right? It was a theocratic impulse. And that was very different than, say, the Dutch-founded area around New York City, where at the time that that New Netherland was founded, that Amsterdam was the most, you know, advanced sort of capitalist city in the Western world, the center of banking and finance and publishing, and had, you know, the hub of a gigantic global trading company with ships going all the way from Asia to Europe and North America. And New Netherland was an extension of that. It was from the very beginning, this little village at the end of Manhattan Island, New Amsterdam, had all those characteristics. And it was a commercial trading port, you know, multi-ethnic, multicultural, very tolerant of various ideas and the freedom of conscience and inquiry. But definitely materialistic and involved in trade, like any city-state is. And those are two completely different models sitting right next to each other in New York and New England, just to illustrate a little of it. And not to say nothing of, you know, the southern slaveholding cultures, particularly the Deep South, which was founded by English colonists from Barbados, slave lords from Barbados, who had perfected a slave plantation society with chain gangs and all the rest in the late 17th century, and their island running out of space, they transplanted their West Indies-style plantation model to the subtropical lowlands of the Carolina colonies that then spread out and created the deep lowland South that we think of as the Cotton South. So that is primarily, I suppose you could say, an economic project. It's really an economic and cultural project that's hierarchical and oligarchic. And the New Netherland model is a commercial globalization trading project from the beginning. But, you know, I don't think you can really see the New England project as having that as its core mission, although the New Englanders absolutely knew how to make money and, you know, would do so and dominate merchant trade and everything else.
But it wasn't their primary goal. Whereas
it wasn't their underlying ideal that it was all about. And that's, you know, part of the thing that one of the many mistakes Bancroft made was assuming that his region's experience was the experience of the entire United States. He was writing essentially a Yankee vision for what the country was in a country that most of the population of which did not live within the greater New England sort of settlement space, and so didn't share those experiences or commonalities. And he was able to have an enormous voice because also for theocratic reasons at the beginning, New England had invested, they believed that everyone should be able to read the Bible and needed to. So from the beginning on the frontier, they had taxpayer-financed public schools and meeting houses and invested in colleges like, you know, Harvard and Yale, and then all these little, you know, what are now liberal arts colleges, but were originally congregational training colleges all along their part of the Midwest, you know, the Beloits and, Madison, which became University of Wisconsin, and all the rest. So they had high literacy, they had almost all the library collections, most of the publishing ability, and in the context of the early 19th century, they basically had all the tools that controlled the conversation. So their voice was outsized, and that led to Bancroft's idea and thesis, you know, being accepted as a first draft pretty rapidly, but also quickly provoked a counter-reaction from intellectuals and men of letters from other parts of the country who did not share those ideals or that background.
On Scenic Roots Talking Writing, my guest has been Colin Woodard, whose book On the Origin of the American Myth Union has just been published. His previous book, American Nations, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 2016. Mr. Woodard will be back next week to continue our conversation on the biographies of the five men who each in their own way contributed to the mythology of the United States of America, a fractious union that is no less fractured in spite of their efforts to craft a unifying narrative of the history of the country. Thanks so much for listening. Please join us next week for Scenic Roots Talking Writing on WUTC.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.